This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about gaslighting as a factor in mental health. And this is a theme close to my heart as someone that has had experience of an abusive relationship. And that's something you can hear me touch on in some of the previous episodes where we've covered relationships as a factor in mental health. And yet in this episode, I was really glad that we got to talk about this in a very broad way in terms of gaslighting as a series of behaviours that can be used to undermine somebody's like sense of self, sense of reality, sense of confidence in their own perceptions of a situation, of a relationship, of whatever the dynamic is. And I think there's so much to be gained from looking at this term specifically, you know, what it really is, because it can be thrown around a little bit online when it's not always accurate, but also the breadth of what this term encompasses. We can see in so many situations, there can be even just elements of gaslighting where it may not form gaslighting in full, but specific behaviours within this, we can notice here, there and everywhere. And there's something to be said for getting familiar with them, really looking out for them in ourselves and in others. And that's very much the path we go down in today's interview with Dr. Monica Vermani, who is a clinical psychologist, an author, and someone that has, as you'll hear in the episode, a very broad background when it comes to supporting people with their mental health, and a perspective I so valued getting to hear today. So with that all said, please enjoy this conversation with Dr. Monica Vermani in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, I'm Dr. Monica Vermani. I'm a clinical psychologist. I work with people with mood, anxiety, and trauma. And in today's world, we have a lot of that going on right now. High stress levels, mood, anxiety, and trauma symptoms have exacerbated. You're starting with talking about my background. I'm born and raised in Toronto, Ontario. I'm born to immigrant parents who came here from India. My dad was here before with work. My mom came after marriage. Growing up, it was a normal household. We didn't have extended family here. And as I grew up, my father had a workplace accident when I was about 6, 7. And at that time, it kind of shifted the course of me and my mother's life, where things fast-forwarded in some ways. Now, looking back, he had post-traumatic stress disorder from a workplace accident. At that time, as a child growing up, it was just a chaotic environment of stress and trying to manage money and manage life and chronic pain and try to figure out who's taking care of him as he healed, because he was in chronic pain and suffering. And my mom was alone here. And so she had me and I had her, and we both grew up quite fast. I probably grew up in some ways faster than her. And my father learned how to take care of himself. So the one interesting thing I learned from my background is everybody has learnings in suffering. And many times, you know, as we grew up, the right people showed up for support or management, even though we didn't have extended family. I was exposed to a meditation teacher very young, about 10, 11, and she used to come to the house and teach us how to meditate. And it was a service. It was free. And it was about teaching you to go inwards and work through anything that pops up for you. It intrigued me. I got quite engrossed in it. My parents, I think, due to the distractions of life, probably didn't focus on meditation the same way as I did, as a sponge absorbing it all. But I was intrigued with that world of charity and helping and working, and got into volunteer work very young in my life, enjoyed volunteering.
And I just wanted to pause there on the meditation. So you said that this was a free service that someone came into your family's life. How did that come about? How was that accessed?
So we had family friends here, and so we had friends, and there was a family friend where the daughter was quite involved in this meditation circle. And so her father knew my family. They knew we were going through tough times at home, and mentioned, I guess, our name. And one of the nuns, the sisters, came over one day and said, hey, let me teach you meditation. It might just make you feel better. And we learned it. And then we enjoyed it so much that, you know, I'm East Indian by background. So meditation is very common practice in the culture. However, it doesn't mean like every family knows about it. Mm-hmm. And as much as my parents knew pieces of it from their upbringing, they didn't have a daily practice. My dad had one. My dad used to read scriptures every day, and he still does. My mom, I think, meditates by the way she feeds others, takes care of others. Meditation gets caught up in weird, you know, misconceptions. Meditation is doing one thing with complete presence, and it's where you lose the concept of time and space. So each and every one of us do meditate. We just don't even realize it. So when you're hanging out with your friends and 4 hours go by, like you did one thing with complete presence, that's meditation. When you're engaging in a hobby or an interest and you lose the concept of time and space and you're like, oh my God, 4 hours went by. That's again, meditation. When you're just outside on a beach, soaking up the sun, doing one thing with complete presence, where you follow your breath, is meditation. Now, following the breath piece, I think in Western world, we focus on the breath bringing you to a meditative state only because it's the fastest way to get you out of your head and into your body, to focus on your body. So, you know, the truth is meditation is when you focus on one thing with complete presence, hobbies, interests, things that you enjoy, soaking up the sun in a park, you know, watching your baby play, you know, watching the birds outside. It doesn't matter what you do, but if you're doing one thing with complete presence, even eating, many times we multitask, we're watching TV and we're eating, or we're talking to our friends and we're on the computer. Like, we're not doing one thing with complete presence many times. And so meditation taught me to do one thing with complete presence. And it also led me to go inward and face what bubbles up. And it helped our family, because I think many times we react to one another when people are not in a good place and personalize it. But when you start having compassion for one another, you realize when people are in pain, they spill over onto others. Mm-hmm. Anger, irritability, frustration, moodiness, right? You're in chronic pain, you're going to be moody. And so instead of us personalizing it, we were taught at a very young age to sometimes have compassion for the person who's in a place of pain and spilling over. Right.
Yes. And I really love the way you described meditation there, because you're so spot on. And yet I've never heard it explained with that simplicity before, because, you know, that's what we are so commonly encouraged to aspire to now in our, you know, hectic modern digital lives, is how can we get back to being present? And in a way with that, kind of get back to the core of being human, of like a lot of how our ancestors would have survived, of like, you've just got to be in the moment, be ready to respond to threats, be ready to see opportunities, to gather, to hunt, to do what you need to do to survive. And whilst in many ways that sounds like a very stressful existence to many of our modern comforts, I think there is, yeah, there's so much to be gained from, okay, how can we simplify our reactions to a complicated world?
Yeah. You know, meditation is about you being at one with yourself. What do you enjoy instead of doing what everybody else wants you to enjoy? Mm-hmm. You know, we all have this battlefield, I call it, within us between our true self, what we want to do, and what people expect of us. And we're always fighting with ourselves because we're always trying to put others ahead of ourselves, or we're trying to do what people expect of us versus what we really want to do. When you meditate, you get to connect with yourself enough to see, what do I want? What do I like? You know, what am I going through? What are my symptoms right now? And then you can address them. The first step to treatment in the work I do is to understand awareness. Awareness is the first step to treatment. But many times we're so busy in our head and we're so busy fulfilling what people expect of us, we don't spend enough time with ourselves to really see what's going on within us. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that can be a big part of everyone's experience growing up, that we can get so externally focused as the expectations and pressures stack up as we age. And in many ways, it sounds like you had a lot of that build up quite quickly, but also you still had, it sounds like, the youth and the open-mindedness that can come with that to really embrace meditation without maybe some of the preconceptions.
Yeah. And it softens you. It softens you to have compassion and personalizing everything, right? Meaning you go inwards and you can pause and reflect. And in that process of pause and reflecting, you stop reacting so much and you start responding, meaning you pause, reflect so you can respond. Versus right now, most of us are so busy, so tired that we're just responding to each other in reactions that are fast, hurtful, personalizing, defensive, guilty, shame, all that stuff.
For sure. Okay? And could you share a little bit about then how you found your profession now and what the kind of stages of that you moved through were?
So now reflecting back, I can see like puzzle pieces putting my life together to where it is now. But at that time, you're just in the middle of it and you're swimming in the middle of a tornado in some ways where life is chaotic. And then this meditation comes in to teach you how to ground yourself. I got involved in a lot of volunteer work as just interest. And then as I grew, I had friends. I started work very young in life. So to help out with household stuff, I grew up working very young. I started a paper route at 10. I had, you know, at 15, I had a job at a department store. And I've juggled 2 to 3 jobs all the way through my school. But during my first job, I had a lot of core friends that were supportive. And one of them was like, you should go into that social work stuff or something. You're really good. You're kind. You listen. You give some good advice. I was like, I don't know. And I applied to a bunch of schools and I got into U of T for a science degree. I also got into an art college at that time. So art wasn't my form of meditation. I did one thing with complete presence at night once in a while, painting and drawing and sculpting. And it was my little meditation place. And I didn't want it as a career, even though I could have pursued it. I had an option. I took U of T. I did the science degree. But from the science stream, I took psychology, sociology, women's studies, and criminology. And doing those 4, I really enjoyed them. So then I specialized and I got into psychology. I did graduate with a science degree, an honors science degree. And because I had psychology and sociology, criminology, women's studies, I also had the opportunity to pursue jobs in corrections or facilities that were a little bit more extreme. And I was volunteering at a women's shelter at that time. I liked working with extremes to toughen up a bit. I was a shy, quiet, you know, East Indian girl from my background. And I ended up breaking out a little bit more by choosing professions where I could work with extremes and learn ways of managing temperament, behaviors, moods, anxiety, traumas. It worked for me. I always thought if I could work with the extremes, I can work with everything in the middle. Mm-hmm. And so I started my career working in women's prisons. Then I worked with men prisons. I worked with sex offenders for a number of years. I've worked at anxiety disorders clinics, Lake Ridge Mental Health Center with children and families with anxiety, UHN, where brain and spinal cord injury people who are paralyzed from the neck down or the hip down. These populations were, again, extremes with mood, anxiety, stress, and trauma. Mm-hmm. And so I've always been considered a bit of a specialist in those areas. But then you can work with everything in the middle, couples counseling, you know, family therapy, substance abuse, working with people on self-esteem, working on learning tools to manage anxiety disorders. Anxiety disorders alone cover so much territory. You got obsessive compulsive disorder, you got panic disorder, you got generalized anxiety disorder, chronic worry, which has increased in today's times. You got social anxiety, you know, worries about scrutiny, criticism, judgment by people. You have specific phobias, fears of heights, snakes, you know, elevators. And then you have trauma, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, where you or somebody close to you is in a life-threatening situation. And then day-to-day triggers take you back to that event and cause you anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure. And I always love when we get to explore like these links that so often mental illnesses can be treated as these conditions in silos. And actually there is so much in common, and sometimes that's where part of the misconceptions can come of like, oh, the symptoms that are shared by so many conditions, that makes them feel a bit more sort of subjective and, you know, open to interpretation than we're encouraged to view science at. And yet science has always been about examining nuance and reestablishing, okay, this is the truth, but is there a truer truth that we can find yeah, so I love that you've talked through them in that way. I also wanted to ask you, if I may, about your sort of drive to go for certain areas where you could work with extremes, as you've described it. Do you think when you look back, that could have been partly informed by some of the experiences you'd gone through where you found like the extremes that can affect whole families was something that you could relate to and you had such a passion for personally?
So unconsciously, I'm sure my family background had a lot to do with me being a caregiver and learning how to take care of others, sometimes at the expense of yourselves, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, those codependency traits. However, I also do feel like missing puzzle pieces, things just kind of fell in my path. So As I mentioned, I was the quiet, shy girl growing up. And in grade school, I was bullied for a bit. So I remember feeling like weak and powerless and feeling like, oh, I wish I could stand up for myself more. But I was this caring soul. I was this caring person. And I didn't know how to stand up for myself without being mean. So that was my battle. And I was still in my meditation. So I would ask some of the coaches who teach meditation, like, how do you kind of stand up for yourself, like turn the other cheek type of thing without being a pushover? So I was always asking these type of questions. And, you know, some of the answers I unfolded is become what you think you need to be to feel stronger in yourself. And that was a hard one for me. But I remember thinking, okay, well, maybe I need to like take things that help me learn how to be a little bit more outgoing, not so shy and quiet. So I took improv. I learned how to laugh at life instead of taking it so seriously. Mm. I took public speaking to be a little bit more comfortable speaking up and projecting my voice. What I realized in life, we compare each other. Like you're born alone, meaning you enter the world alone and you leave the world alone. But the journey is amongst others. And the purpose of being amongst others is to kind of compare yourself to them to see where you're at and work on yourself. So to me, our goal is always to try to become a higher, better version of ourselves. So when I saw somebody better than me, I was like, or I perceived as better as me, I said, let me acquire the skill and become it. So when I would see other people doing some cool things, I was like, let me try that. And I would admire people who took jobs on that were extremes. And so there was a part of me that's like, oh, well, why don't you become it then? Mm-hmm. Go for it. Apply. What do you lose? So the one best thing my mom always taught me is hard work ethics. Mm-hmm. And my mom also taught me, try. What do you lose? You know, you want a discount on a table? Ask for it. Like, what do you lose? They say no. And I did that with jobs. You know, and I applied for jobs that maybe on average, if I wasn't from this background, yeah, wouldn't have pursued. I would have been nervous too. And luckily it worked for me. I always pursued jobs and said, I'd work hard, give me a chance. And when I'd get in, they'd fall in love with me. They'd be like, she works hard. She has good work ethic. She builds rapport well. And I was good at the work. And it would work for me. So the extremes was another way for me to learn how to be something that I wasn't at that time. Mm-hmm. You're around in an environment. Like our journey is learning how to become a better version of ourselves. If I admired people who spoke well in groups and stuff like this, well, if I surrounded myself around them, I'd learn it through modeled behavior. You know, many of us learn so much from model behavior. 0 to 10, you're learning it in your household. And neither one of my parents are that outgoing. So I wasn't going to learn it in my household. I had to learn it from outside of me.
Yes. Oh, I love that. It won't surprise you to know when I speak to counselors, it's sometimes like beautifully difficult because you can pack in so much insight that I'm like, oh, there's 100 different threads to pull there. And in particular, I want to pick up on what you shared about bullying, because you've highlighted there something that I think is so often missed to the detriment of those that have been through it, that we can get so caught up in a victim-villain narrative that we can lose actually how much innate strength there can be in those that are commonly targets, because it so often is the kindest kid in the class, the one that even in a situation where you think, how are they empathizing with this person? They're still considering the bully. There's a million reasons why they're not going to hit back beyond just, do I think it would go worse for me, or do I think they're stronger than me or not?
Just to continue on that one, when you're born, you really, when you look at children, they're unconditionally loving. They live in a place of truth. They say it as it is. Like, we admire children because they have this love. You don't see a kid looking in the mirror and scrutinizing themselves. You know, children are born in that place of like high self-esteem. And then as we grow, we lose it. Mm-hmm. We end up taking on concepts and we personalize things that happen to us or things that are around us. And it shapes us to start believing in things that are not necessarily true. And so with bullying, it's the same thing. You go through hurtful experiences with people and you get confused. Like, why is this happening to me? What did I do? And you personalize it. Like, maybe I am ugly. That's why they call me ugly. And when you hold on to a concept, you personalize it. You make it a part of your reality. Mm-hmm. Like breakups. Many people will say, I felt like a failure. I'm like, well, failed. Life is a series of experiences. That's it. We as human beings label positive and negative to our experiences. The truth is life is just a series of experiences. And half of the work I do is helping you reconceptualize how you labeled your experience as maybe negative to something more positive. That bullying experience taught me to stand up for myself. I don't like the fact I went through it, but it did teach me something. One, showed me a flaw about myself that somebody could take me for granted. Two, it also gave me an opportunity to say, I don't know how to deal with this. Who do I learn from to learn how to speak up, advocate for myself, get help? What do I need to do to correct the situation?
Yeah.
And so if you don't get caught up in the suffering, but you get caught up in the lesson around it, you do grow.
Exactly. And you have reminded me of what I forgot that I was going to say earlier, which was the other part of that insight is around the incredible restraint that those that go through bullying show. And you've really been an example of it there in what you've shared as well, because ultimately that's why you always win long term, because you took those experiences, you found ways to apply them through learning, and now you have the tools to deal with bullying directed towards you, but also you have the emotional insight, the intelligence, the restraint has only grown. So you have so much more power than that person that, you know, why are people lashing out? Often it is to do with their own inner turmoil that they're just throwing out on the world or spilling over, as you said.
But remember what I was saying earlier about modeled behavior. Because I was in meditation classes too, we were taught to have compassion for those in low mm-hmm. self-esteem. And what does that mean? You know, when a bully's out there doing, when you're in pain, you spill over onto others. So to me, as I look at this bullying, we're like, you're not actually trying to hurt me. You're just spilling over onto me. So I didn't personalize their behavior as directly about me. I saw it as this person's in a place of low self-esteem or has a difficult childhood or something's going on at home where there's anger and violence or something that they're spilling over onto me, because we learn anger. We learn these things. And so, you know, I had a different way of seeing that bully, even though it hurt, even though I was, you know, upset and pissed off as a kid. Mm-hmm. I was also someone who was like, wow, I just need to stop this behavior and how it's hurting me. But I wasn't angry at the bully, because the bully was a product of who knows how many different factors that made them in a place of pain, spilling over onto others.
Yeah. Yeah. You're ultimately two people that are products of your environment. And I think this kind of links into our theme for today's episode of gaslighting. So do you mind sharing first off what that term means? Because we talked off air about it can be thrown around a lot, not always with accuracy.
Yes. Gaslighting is a form of emotional and psychological abuse where a person uses verbal or behavioral tricks to convince another person that they're losing their mind, not perceiving things accurately, or in the wrong, and cannot just trust their own judgment. So, you know, why do people do this? Like, it's an interesting thing. It's a way to get control over another person and their situation. Gaslighters are seen in media and movies as master manipulators, but sometimes these people develop tactics through modeled behavior growing up in a household that is abusive, or dynamics where there's a dominant and a subordinate party, as well as they don't know how else to control relationships or be in them. Like, if you grew up in a household where mom and dad had that dynamic where one was always blaming or controlling the other by turning things around, well, you just assume this is the way to be. and they're looking at it as, who do I want to be, victim or perpetrator? So they're choosing sometimes, right? Well, like, before you hit me, before you yell at me, I'm going to yell at you. Before you control me, I'm going to control you. And so sometimes unconsciously, we choose a role from seeing them in our background, but we choose it because we think it's a better role, not necessarily that it's healthier.
Yeah.
And many times, if you look at chemistry as familiarity, we sometimes attract people like our parents in our own lives because we're repeating dynamics that we see. So it's important sometimes for people to pause and reflect and look at dynamics. When it comes to gaslighting, you can learn it in your household and not even be aware of it. And then you're repeating it. And until you don't have a number of broken relationships or a number of situations where people are looking at you saying, you know what, like, you keep turning things around. And like, such a subtle way of making someone doubt themselves that the person feels powerless and feels wronged when they communicated their needs. Mutual power dynamics takes confidence. And many times gaslighters are people who don't have high self-esteem or feel like that's the only way to keep someone in their life, or they need to be dominant because that was a role modeling that they were seeing,
yeah.
Right? Some people ask me, like, how do gaslighters invalidate people's feelings? And they challenge the facts of your perception. You know, they need to be right in a situation. And they also have a tendency to criticize, blame, making verbally abusive statements, intimidation tactics of chipping away at your self-esteem so that you start doubting, well, maybe I'm the problem here. Maybe I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough. Denying responsibility for something they have done or may have done, like missing a dinner date or, you know, not responding to texts, or they will deny responsibility. Shifting responsibility for hurtful and destructive behavior. Many times verbal or physical abuse or an affair, gaslighters can say, you made me do it. Or, you know, I did it because you weren't there for me, or you weren't giving me what I needed, or I'm not the problem, you are. You need to go get help. You're crazy. Mm-hmm. And it shifts things around. You know, that term came from a play. And the play was about a husband who was, you know, subtly manipulating and controlling his wife to get her assets and her inheritance by moving things around, by taking things away and saying, you've done it. You've lost it. You're losing your mind. And she slowly over time believed it. And, you know, it's such a subtle way because there's good moments and bad. But gaslighters can be people who plan it to gain control because that's the way they think that they have to be. And then there's also the person who unintentionally doesn't even know they're doing it until the awareness comes in. When I wrote the article a few months ago, I had some of my patients, you know, come into sessions and say, do I do this with my partner? Can we explore this? And they were already working on themselves, but they had the insight of, when I'm angry, I do turn it around on them. Mm-hmm. Or when I'm defensive, I turn it around on them. And it helped me realize, wow, you know, it's kind of nice to write these articles. It makes people reflect on, am I doing anything that is hurtful, even if the person is not pointing it out for me? I think Our own responsibility is to go inwards and see, what are my demons? What are my dark spots? What are the things I have to work on? I always tell everybody, anybody can go to therapy. You're perfect and a work in progress at the same time. You got to work on the work in process, right?
Love that. No, and I really appreciate the way you've shared where a lot of this behavior comes from, because so often the conversation is dominated by, okay, these are the traits, these are the things to look out for. And the reality is gaslighting is a very broad term. And so much of what we think of as emotional abuse can fall under this, can have, you know, shared traits.
With online dating right now, and like, I listen to the youth going out there, like, people get scared of getting hurt. And so when you see any subtle hint of a behavior that may feel controlling or something got turned around, I do want people to pause and reflect and be like, okay, is this a pattern or is this a one-off? You know, sometimes we all make mistakes. We have to have compassion for one another. To be human is to err. And, You know, I find sometimes we're so quick to label with these type of terms and then make people feel like there may be bad people. And I'm not saying there aren't people who actually do this with the intention to cause harm, but there are some people who are doing it without the awareness that they're doing it. So let's really try to judge not the whole person from head to toe, but the behaviors that they are doing. And many times when people have awareness, they do change, or they want to change, because deep down inside, all of us want to be accepted and loved. They just don't know another way to do it because they were role modeled this. Mm-hmm. And so when you teach them another way, that's the beauty of me working in correctional facilities. I realize a lot of people did the best they could with what they had. And the moment they knew better, they changed. But the first step to treatment is awareness. I write these articles and we do these podcasts to bring awareness.
And I think that's really important for the awareness of the person being gaslit as well. Because if we fall into this idea that, you know, toxic behaviors mean that person is therefore inherently and permanently toxic, then that can form a part of why people push down their instincts and see these behaviors and think, oh no, but I love them, and you know, they're a good person, and I know that they have potential, and therefore it invalidates it. Whereas actually those things can be true. These behaviors could also be toxic.
They both can be true.
And the truth is, you don't need to stand for them. And that's the empowerment piece of, okay, look out for these things. What can we do about them so that they're not then becoming your problem? You're not falling into this.
You just said something very valuable that I want to bring attention to, because we focus on these perpetrators, that's what we want to call them. But many times when people are in gaslighting situations, they see themselves as powerless. We forget that they got to work on themselves too. This scenario or dynamic is happening because that person has work to do too. It's not just the gaslighter. Mm-hmm. You know, a person who's in those situations needs to pause and reflect, take a step back, just like I did when I was being bullied, and say, okay, what is it about me? I don't stand up for myself, or I believe people's comments instead of trusting myself. I sometimes say in therapy, other people's opinion of you is none of your business. Your opinion of yourself is what matters. Do you have a good opinion of yourself? But if you're solid in knowing you, it's harder for a gaslighter to actually be able to be successful at their tactics. Meaning, if you call me green, and I know I'm not green, it bounces off me like Teflon. But you call me stupid, and inside I have an insecurity that maybe I'm not smart enough, then I triggered and I respond with reaction and defensiveness. Meaning, when people say something, if you are reacting right away, you might believe it. So maybe there's got to be a part of you pausing, reflecting, and getting grounded in your opinion of you, grounded in your intention of things, knowing yourself better. So that way, when somebody calls you green, you're like, yeah, whatever, it doesn't matter. But when somebody calls you stupid, you're like, oh, I'm not that either. I'm going to let that one go too, right? There's got to be a part of you recognizing, what do I react to? And having more awareness and not believing what people say, because many times, like I said, when you're in pain, you spill over onto others. However, when repeated people are saying something, you might want to recognize you might be the problem. When repeated people are saying something, or repeated people are having the same problem with you, you might have to acknowledge and take accountability that, whoa, there might be a trait about me that I am a pushover. Or I am someone who endures bullying or puts up with abuse. And, you know, you're not always responsible. You're not responsible for people's behavior. It is important for you to recognize that you choose people, but we're all learning from each other. You can make a relationship work with anybody. Your goal is to find your best possible match. And so sometimes these people come in your life to show you how to recognize that you have to work on your self-esteem. You have to stand up for yourself. You have to be more aware. And you're such a caregiver that you dismiss other people at your expense, or you love other people at your own expense.
Yeah. And on my other podcast, which is about dating and relationships, that's something that we explore a lot, is your patterns. And yeah, that idea that, like, it's not, even if you can acknowledge that you're the problem in certain ways, that doesn't mean you are a problem. There's still ways that your behaviours are the things that can change and that don't need to be permanent about you, and how easy it is to fall into toxic patterns, whoever you are in the relationship. Like we talked about earlier, how there can be an attraction to familiarity, certain things mm-hmm. you grew up around, certain, even your first relationship. How many mm-hmm. people can have one relationship and then try and model that for years and years in the future? And then they wonder why the same problems come up when the people that they're dating are so similar. It's going to happen.
And it's changing schemas. So in psychology, we call schemas maps in your head of information. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you're born 0 to 10, you develop schemas of, you know, dad works a lot, work's a value, you know, mom's a clean freak, cleaning's a value. But you also develop schemas about love and intimacy. And many times it's important for you to recognize, just because you have a comfort with one schema, change always feels uncomfortable. And so when I help people break cycles of abusive relationships because they grew up in one with their parents being abusive, it's about them getting comfortable receiving, them getting comfortable in a healthy dynamic. And it first feels uncomfortable because it's like a new pair of shoes. You just haven't broken them in yet. You're just so used to the old story playing that that feels automatic pilot. And that's why many times there's a comfort when you meet someone with familiarity. You're like, oh, I know you forever. You know them forever. You knew them from your father or mother. And now it's nice for you to realize, okay, but that's not the marriage I want. So let me see what dynamic I want. And am I choosing what is healthy for me, or am I repeating a cycle?
Relatable.
I've been there. I've been there too.
And I feel like we should get into some of the nitty-gritty of like the practicality of, okay, we're seeing a lot of these behaviors, and what do we do? So first off, if you're seeing these behaviors directed towards you, what can we do to combat them? At what stage do we know, should we get out of a situation?
So, you know, in loving relationships, you know, each and every one of us have our own threshold, and we also have our own tolerances. I always tell people, don't beat yourself up for how long you've been in a dynamic like this, because it wasn't, like you were saying, ugly and horrible all the way through. There were pieces that were great. So, you know, when you're judging someone, judge the negative behaviors in them. There were obviously good behaviors, otherwise you wouldn't have been with them, right? Now, the only thing is when you break up with someone, or when you're in a place where there's more and more conflict, somehow the negative gets magnified and you forget all the good things that kept you there this long, and you start putting yourself down. Meaning we start having low self-esteem about ourselves staying in relationships like this. And it's not about that. It's about compassion for yourself, you know, that you're learning and you're growing. And it's about pausing and reflecting. And we dictate the level of respect a person treats us by. And so it is an inner job, right? There's got to be some work on yourself of, am I putting up with something that is not healthy for my own self-esteem? Am I always taking the blame? Am I always letting go of the fight? Am I someone who's letting someone abuse me verbally by calling me crazy, or telling me I need to go get help over and over, or telling me that nobody's going to be with me? That's abuse. And we have to start recognizing when we are even in a situation like that, what's my self-esteem? Am I standing up for myself? So being aware that when people are insulting you or abusing you and you tolerate it, are you in high self-esteem, or should that be work that you need to do to get your self-esteem up so that you can set healthy boundaries to say, stop, that's not acceptable in this relationship. Okay. I just told a person last week, her boyfriend told her to F off. And I said to her, have you ever sworn at someone? She goes, no. And I said, what did you do with that? And she's like, I just took it as he was just angry. And I said, why are you dismissing it? You never swear at anybody because you know it's hurtful. Did it hurt your feelings? She goes, yes. So then you need to make it clear to this person that was the first and last time they ever swear at you.
Yes, I love that.
She looked at me and she said, that's exactly what I felt on the inside. I just didn't have the courage to say it. I'm like, why didn't you have the courage to just speak up and say, dictate the terms of the relationship you want? This is a new relationship. You let it go, they're going to swear again. Yeah. And if you didn't like it the first time, you're not going to like it anytime. So why aren't we saying, hey, that's not a part of what I want in my relationship. I will never swear at you. And so I would like you never to swear at me. Do unto others as you want done to you. You have to dictate the level of respect a person treats you by.
Yeah.
And I learned that one in one of my jobs. I was working at a hospital once and I was sharing office cubicles, and this supervisor came in, who wasn't even mine, came in ranting and yelling and belittling the coworker that wasn't in her seat next to me and rambling away at me. And I said to him, and I was this junior student as a research assistant, looked up and I said, stop. Number one, I'm not here to listen to you yell and scream about somebody else that's not here. Secondly, this is not my problem. I'm going to leave the office. You might want to calm down. And I walked out. because he wasn't my boss. Mm-hmm. And then 2 days later, he came in my office and apologized and said, I'm sorry, it was wrong for me to come in, ask you where she was and rant about her and belittle her. And I said, yeah, it was wrong. And I won't tolerate, don't do it again, please. And that was it.
I love that. And that's what you need to do.
You, even though I'm scared, you have to stand up for yourself. And sometimes those things are happening to you to teach you how to stand up. I didn't even know I had that courage until that day.
Yeah. Yeah, but, to give you the practice. And I mean, the only thing I'd add to what you shared about the client whose partner was telling her to F off, you know, the second time they say it and it feels like they really mean it, just do it. Like, that's the point I'm at now. You don't need to tell me that I'm bad in your life twice. I'll be gone the second time, sure. And then, of course, they'll turn around because they don't really mean it. And that's how you know it's
abuse. And don't get me wrong. I do couples counseling and I have sometimes couples belittling each other in front of me. And I'm like, do you speak to this, each other like this all the time? Oh, yeah, we do. And if you like it and that's the way you want to be, power to you. But when you're somebody who's like, I don't like it, I feel bad, I don't want somebody belittling me or calling me names or whatever, then make it clear that you're not going to tolerate that. Just because somebody maybe has this learned behavior from their upbringing or another bad relationship in their life doesn't mean they won't change. If they like you enough, they will. But number one, you got to go inwards and know what your rule book is and what you'll tolerate and what you won't.
Yeah, because otherwise you're facilitating the behavior. If you're showing up and taking it, yes, it's their abuse, but we still don't want to be complicit in that. So sometimes it's standing up and sometimes it's just leaving.
And that's where you go back to, like, you're perfect and a work in progress. Sometimes people are like, I don't really need therapy, but I wanted to see what you're about. I'm like, we all need therapy. We all can fine tune our self-esteem. We all can be better coaches. We can all be better bosses. We can all be better people. Mm-hmm. But how are you going to be better in the bubble of your own life without knowing there's better? Sometimes we go to professionals because they help break our mindset to learn how to be better. You know, a lot of what I do is take you from where you are to where you want to be. The gap are skills that you can learn, tools you can learn, you know, and many people who struggle in abusive or dynamics where they feel taken for granted, you learn confidence, just like you learn anger, just like you learn abuse, right?
Yeah, and that's it. What are you going to accept as the things that you learn from this relationship? What is the story you're going to allow? Which is so important when a really core part of gaslighting is undermining your reality, making you question your own judgment to the extent where you're so disempowered that they could tell you it's nighttime when it's day and there's a chance you might believe it. And of course, this is something that goes on in stages and builds to a point where, you know, a lot of the behaviors that exist later on, we would reject, but it's the way that it builds in subtlety to intensity is so dangerous.
Mm-hmm. You said that word, allow. And I think, you know, that makes people feel bad about this. Just because you allow it doesn't mean you're a bad person or you're weak or you're powerless. You know, I think I always tell people, like, it is about you working on your self-esteem to understand, I choose this relationship. I choose to walk away from it. I choose to set boundaries. I choose not to set boundaries. I choose to put up with something or give someone a chance, and I choose not to. There is a choice element on things. I choose on how, you can't choose making circumstances that you met this person, but you can choose if you're going to stay, choose if you're going to leave, choose if you're going to set boundaries. So I might not choose my trauma of being in a car accident, but I choose how I respond. I choose how to get the treatment. I choose things around it. And so people feel powerless by the circumstance coming in your life. But remember, there's choices, you know, all throughout it.
I think that's maybe a way that you could potentially reframe it is, okay, maybe not allow, but are you turning up for this behavior? Are you coming to this relationship every day and being a part of this behavior? And something I wanted to share with you that's happened recently is I did experience a gaslighting situation in a work environment. And even though this is something I've worked to understand, so often the conversation is from a, you know, relationship point of view. But of course, this can happen within any two people in any situation. And mm-hmm. I won't get into it too much, but essentially what it was that happened was I was working on a new project, and straight away I could see that it was very chaotic, and I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to commit the time to sort things out to make the project work, because somebody had to sort the chaos. And when I did come to the difficult decision of walking away from it, the person that I was primarily working with, who was in charge, then went straight into gaslighting behaviours of denying that I was leaving the project at all. And then I found myself in loads of really stressful situations of team meetings, where I realised in that moment that nobody had been told, that all the people that should have been made aware, she'd been lying to. And I didn't want to have it out on a series of Zoom calls, to try and set the record straight. And so in the end, I had to go over that person's head and inform people myself, because I wasn't going to allow myself to sit in this false narrative. And of course, the objective of it seemed to be that by enforcing this narrative counter to reality based on what she wanted to be true, and really enforcing that focus rather than what was actually happening, the hope was I changed my mind and I would stick around, because that felt easier than resisting these toxic and abusive behaviours.
But you chose so much here. I'm really proud of you sharing this example. It happens with siblings, with coworkers, with friends, but the key is this: all human suffering is a catalyst for change. Whenever there's turmoil and you're struggling on the inside with symptoms and you're like, oh my God, what's happening here? How is this happening? You're suffering, right? You, as much as you're not telling us the details, at one point you were really struggling with this. You were stressed. Maybe it impacted your sleep. You had anxiety about it. It was a problem that caused suffering. But to me, whenever there's suffering in your life, it's a catalyst for change. You got to look at, okay, what is that change? Is it me leaving this job? Is it me speaking up? Is it me standing up for myself? What is the change that this suffering is making me try to do? I actually always see whenever we have turmoil, you shift. So you could have left the job. You could have had conflict with a person. You went above their head and worked through it. But that was the change. And then you chose to stay and things have, I'm assuming, settled down.
I didn't choose to stay. No, I did leave. But that was the thing.
But that was a catalyst for change. Yeah, and maybe you were meant to be where you are now because that situation happened.
Yeah, because that was part of recognizing it, that it took me a little bit longer because it was a work situation as opposed to a relationship. And I hadn't had as much practice picking up on these traits in this different environment. But when I saw them and I could see the motivation of, oh, this person is trying to force me to stay rather than address the problems on this project, talk things through with me like an adult, have the conversation. None of that was happening. And, that wasn't behavior I was going to tolerate. And if anything, just proved to me, okay, I was right. This is a toxic environment. And I'm glad that, I saw it quickly and, we'll see. Quite a few other people have left since, that's all I'll say. But it's one of these things that the behaviours can be so insidious that we have to work on having that strength of character to resist them, because the natural instinct is to try and kind of placate toxic behaviours and how can we compromise? How can we move towards their reality? So even when we are conscious of these behaviours, we can still fall into the trap of compromising who we are and our lived experience to try and appease
this person. Society has that, right? Mm-hmm. There's this quote I throw around a lot: being well adjusted to a sick society is unhealthy, but also being well adjusted to sick or toxic environment is unhealthy. Many times we don't even realize we're in a toxic environment, but when you realize it, we're taught in society to well adjust to it, right? You need your paycheck, you got to people please, you got to compete with others. It's a good position, suck it up and stick it out. We sometimes teach people to stay in toxic, ill environment, and it takes a lot of courage to walk away. But always remember that it's an individual journey. You trying to be a better version of you. What environments help you thrive? What environments actually crumble you? Mm-hmm. Or chip away at you and your confidence and make you feel depressed or anxious. I think our journey is learning to be aware. And a lot of what we talked about today is about bringing awareness to, am I in toxic environments? Am I working on myself to be living in my highest and best version of me. And by standing up and doing these things, you give yourself opportunities to go find workplaces that match your values versus ones that deplete you.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I totally agree with that. And it's been something that I've wanted to cover on the podcast for some time, as I mentioned to you off air, because, you know, gaslighting is such a big factor in so many people's interactions. And, you know, I'm really glad we got to talk about the elements behind that, you know, what it is that causes a lot of this behavior. Because I don't know, I feel like sometimes there's so much focus on how somebody can be undermining your narrative, but there also needs to be a focus on, okay, what is the narrative that they're so desperate to uphold? And why can theirs be the only one? And what is it, you know, they're trying to gain out of this, like we've said, often unconsciously?
In a mutually respected relationship, whether it's workplace, friendships, or relationship, you know, it's important to realize that you need to have confidence to feel good to share power. And so whenever there's a power dynamic that you feel like you're not sharing it, you're feeling dominated, it's good to question, is this a healthy environment? Is this a healthy dynamic between us?
Mm-hmm. And on that good note, we will start to wrap up. And so if people want to find out more about your work, not only do you work in a whole range of environments, I don't quite know how you fit it all in. You also have a book where each of us can connect with so many of your insights.
My book is called A Deeper Wellness, and you can definitely find it on Amazon. It's, if you want to go online to read about it, you can go on to addeeperwellness.com. And if you want to find out any information about me, including my podcast of all my articles that I've been writing throughout the pandemic, weekly there's an article. I record the article for people who are in chronic pain and can't read and they would like to hear my voice, as well as have a meditation every week and actionable steps on Wednesdays. So you can find me on Facebook, on Instagram, and on my website. It's just drmonicavermani.com. Mm-hmm.
And I love that. As someone with dyslexia, I particularly appreciate that skill of being able to read your work, provide it in a different format, and do so in a way that's very effortless. I definitely sound like I'm reading when I read things on the podcast. But your definition of gaslighting, I think you were reading some of that from your notes. And it sounded very natural.
Thank you.
So we will wrap up there. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. It was really nice meeting you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.